This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
The headlines: Yemen's health minister says the Saudi war on the Arab country has left more than 3,800 children dead and over 400,000 others in acute malnutrition. Britain and the European Union are expected to announce a Christmas Eve trade deal after 10 months of Brexit talks. And Russia sets a coronavirus double record, registering nearly 30,000 cases and 635 deaths in the past 24 hours. Hello and welcome, everybody. Here in the Iranian capital, Tehran, this is World News. Our top story for this half hour: Yemen's health minister says more than 3,800 children have been killed in the Saudi-led war on the country. Taha al-Mutawakkil said more than 400,000 children are also suffering from severe malnutrition due to the Saudi aggression and blockade. He slammed Riyadh for targeting Yemen's healthcare infrastructure. He added the country is witnessing an increase in birth defects due to unconventional weapons used by Saudi-led forces. Al-Mutawakkil said the United Nations is complicit in Saudi crimes by removing the kingdom from its child killer blacklist. In July, Saudi Arabia launched a devastating war on Yemen in early 2015. Tens of thousands of people, mostly civilians, have been killed in what the UN described as the worst humanitarian crisis in the world. Abdul Latif al-Washali says the killing of Yemeni children by Saudi Arabia shows the catastrophic situation in the war-torn nation.
These numbers means that the atrocities and the war crimes of Saudi Arabia against the children of Yemen are countless. They targeted children with airstrikes. 3,800 children were killed by these airstrikes, and many thousands more were left with disabilities. We have over 2 million children acutely malnourished, and over 400,000 children are severely malnourished and under famine-like conditions. These numbers show to the world the catastrophic situation and dire condition of children in Yemen. And the Ministry of Health is trying to put the world on the image of these catastrophic numbers of children. They are watching silently an entire people, including women and the children, being deprived of their basics of life. We need the blockade to be lifted so we can live again.
Britain and the European Union are in last-minute negotiations to reach a post-Brexit trade deal. The two sides are reportedly resolving some small differences over fishing rights. Sources in London and Brussels say the UK and the EU are on the cusp of striking an agreement. British Prime Minister Boris Johnson held a late-night conference call with his senior ministers and negotiators in Brussels over legal texts. He's expected to talk by phone with EU Commission Chief Ursula von der Leyen to seal the deal. The United Kingdom formally left the EU on January the 31st. It has been in a transition period since then, under which rules on trade, travel, and business remained unchanged. But for the end of this year, it will be treated by Brussels as a third country. Europe keeps struggling with the second wave of COVID-19, with daily cases and deaths remaining high in several countries. Russia has confirmed new single-day records of nearly 30,000 cases and 635 deaths in 24 hours. Germany also reported over 32,000 new infections in the same period, pushing its total caseload to over 1.58 million. Germany's new death toll rose by 802 to over 28,000. The country went into a strict lockdown on December 16th to contain the spread of the virus. In Ukraine, the total number of people who have contracted the disease surpassed the 1 million mark. The country also registered over 17,000 deaths. The Ukrainian government also imposed strict measures, including nighttime curfews. China has become the latest country to suspend flights to and from Britain after the European country reported a new, more infectious strain of the coronavirus.
Given the exceptional nature of the virus mutation and its potential impact, and to ensure the healthy travel of Chinese and foreign personnel, China has studied the measures taken by various countries and suspended flights between China and the UK after full assessment.
The official added China will closely monitor the situation and adjust the preventive measures accordingly. More than 40 countries across the world have blocked flights or travel links with the UK. The bans are aimed at halting the spread of the new strain. Scientists have warned that the strain is up to 70% more transmissible. However, there is no evidence it is deadlier. The World Health Organization says new strains are a normal part of the evolution of a pandemic. Iran's Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif has reacted to the latest accusations by U.S. President Donald Trump against Tehran. In a Twitter post, Zarif said Trump cannot divert attention from his catastrophic failures at home by putting its own citizens at risk abroad. Zarif made the comment after the U.S. president once again threatened Iran and blamed it for Sunday's rocket attacks on the American embassy in Iraq. Trump said he would hold Tehran responsible for any American deaths. Earlier, Secretary of State Mike Pompeo also made similar remarks claiming Iran-backed groups had conducted the attack. Tehran dismissed those accusations as irresponsible, saying Washington wants to create tension in the region with false claims. Political commentator David Yahoubian says he believes the U.S. president is not interested in starting a war.
Likely President Trump is not interested in generating a war at this point, and this would basically ruin whatever legacy he would have had in not initiating at least any new stupid American wars abroad. But I think the key figure to focus on is the self-declared Christian Zionist zealot, Mike Pompeo, who also has future political interests in campaigning in mind, who himself is chomping at the bit to start some sort of open kinetic exchange between Iran and the United States. And his tweet immediately after the rocket attack on the Green Zone, I think, is indicative of his agenda to try to foment as much ill will and potentially violence between Iran and the United States before the Trump regime exits in January. This is a man who has bragged about the training he received in the CIA to lie, cheat, and steal. We must remember, in historical context, the United States has been at war for 226 of its 244 years. That is 94% of its history.
A group of 150 U.S. House Democrats has sent a letter to President-elect Joe Biden urging him to return to the 2015 Iran nuclear deal without preconditions. The jointly signed letter also called on the incoming administration to lift some of the sanctions imposed on Iran by the administration of President Donald Trump. The signatory said diplomatic steps should be taken to restore constraints on Iran's nuclear program and bring both Washington and Tehran to the JCPOA compliance as a starting point for further negotiations. They noted that Trump's withdrawal from the accord had not only impacted U.S. relationships with its key allies, but also diminished Washington's influence on the global stage. The U.S. withdrew from the UN-endorsed agreement in 2018 and reimposed unilateral sanctions on Iran.
The sworn enemy of the Iran nuclear deal will be leaving office very soon. The U.S. President Donald Trump, who unilaterally withdrew America from the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action in May 2018, left no stones unturned to completely destroy the JCPOA. Trump managed to significantly undermine the hard-earned international deal, but he failed to achieve his ultimate goal of killing the deal. Now, just weeks before Trump becomes a former U.S. president, the remaining signatories to the nuclear deal renewed their commitment this week to preserve it. The foreign ministers of Iran, China, Russia, Germany, France, and the United Kingdom agreed on Monday that no party should set fresh preconditions on a revival of the JCPOA. Their statement is believed to be paving the way for Washington and Tehran to come back into full compliance when Joe Biden takes office in January. Trump tried to destroy the deal by imposing tough sanctions and scaring off other countries from doing business with Iran. In response, Tehran has rolled back some of its JCPOA commitments. The next U.S. president will need to remove Trump's favorite sanctions against Iran, and Tehran, in return, will be expected to put back in place certain limitations on its nuclear program based on the JCPOA.
But if they return to the nuclear deal and into full compliance in action, Tehran will do the same by returning practically into full compliance. What is important here is that that return by the U.S. or some other parties to the nuclear deal into compliance, if it happens, theoretically, that will not suffice. What they need to do is that they return practically and in action.
The U.S. president-elect has pledged to restore the JCPOA when he takes office. Will America take this opportunity to rejoin international diplomacy and multilateralism?
U.S. President-elect Joe Biden will be sworn in on January the 20th. Biden was deeply involved in the process of making the nuclear deal with Iran in 2015. Now he has promised to bring the U.S. back to the accord, but many observers say his promises may be too little too late, as Iran has serious grievances about the extensive economic damage America's unilateral withdrawal has caused. Meanwhile, Iran's top diplomat has had tough words not only for the United States, but also, that is, for the European signatories to the deal. Mohammad Javad Zarif has said the Europeans are in serious breach of the JCPOA. That's because, he says, they failed to fulfill promises of better trade with Iran, among other obligations.
The Iranian Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif has repeatedly said that American sanctions deprived Iran of the benefits that his country is entitled to under the nuclear deal. Iran's top diplomat says the Europeans share the blame of the irreparable economic harm to Iranians. On Monday, Zarif took to Twitter after the meeting with his counterparts from China, Russia, Germany, France, and the UK. He posted a chart showing how trade between Iran and the EU has gone down over the past years, despite repeated European promises of better economic ties under the JCPOA. Zarif warned that this is the last chance for the Europeans to save the deal. The top diplomat said that Tehran will quickly reverse the measures that it took in response to the U.S. withdrawal and European breaches if they perform their duties well. Iranians are undoubtedly infuriated by the West's failure or unwillingness to properly implement the deal. Recently, Iran's parliament passed a piece of legislation that would prevent U.N. inspections of Iranian nuclear sites if sanctions are not eased within 2 weeks after Biden takes office. The new law would also require the administration to enrich uranium to the 20% level using advanced centrifuges. Some senior European diplomats, like the UK Foreign Secretary Dominic Raab, said that Iran should not further dilute its nuclear commitments. Some observers believe, however, that instead of lecturing Iran, the EU should immediately focus on how it can properly fulfill its own commitments.
I think the one side that can have demands is Iran, because after the withdrawal of the United States from the nuclear deal, that was Tehran who remained in the deal. Iran showed strategic patience for a year, and after that 1 year, Iran's reduction of commitments happened under the terms of the nuclear deal. So they have done the violation, and the Europeans were, despite their words and promises, were unable to compensate the U.S. withdrawal and exit from the nuclear deal.
Time is fast running out. Iran's top diplomat insists that no democratic country should expect the government to violate the deadlines set by the recently approved parliamentary legislation.
Palestinians in the Gaza Strip have held a protest rally against the UN decision to reduce its aid services in the impoverished enclave. They say the reduction has negatively impacted their daily lives amid Israeli blockade and pandemic. Zuhra Shabat has more in this report.
The Palestinian Refugees Committee in the Gaza Strip organized a rally against the UN AIDS and Health Services reduction. Palestinian refugees who have impacted badly by this reduction participated in the demonstration, calling for the world body's attention to the dire condition in the impoverished enclave.
It's our right to get the UN's aid services. People here are living in a deteriorating condition amid the pandemic. People here can't afford living, and now, with the reduction of the UN aid services, their life is getting even worse.
Palestinians believe the reduction in aid services by the United Nations Relief and Works Agency for Palestinian Refugees, UNRWA, is an attempt by the U.S. to liquidate the humanitarian organization. Earlier, the U.S. announced plans to withhold $65 million of aid to the UNRWA until further notice.
By reducing the refugees' aid, the UN is standing beside the Israeli occupation at the expense of Palestinians' rights. We are calling for our rights, and the UN should fulfill its commitments.
The demonstrators call on the international community to reverse the reduction decision by the UN and keep on supporting the Palestinian refugees who have lost their lands and were expelled since 1948.
The reduction policy aims at reducing the aid services step by step until Palestinians are completely deprived of their rights. The UNRWA was established to help and support Palestinian refugees. The reduction policies serve Israel's interests.
UNRWA was established to aid the 700,000 Palestinians who were expelled from their homes during the war surrounding Israeli occupation's establishment in 1948.
More than the half of the 2 million people in the Gaza Strip are dependent on support from UNRWA, and depriving them from the services they need will worsen the living conditions. Ruba Shabit, Gaza.
An alliance of local parties has emerged victorious in Indian-controlled Kashmir elections. The elections come after India stripped Kashmir's semi-autonomous status last year. Our correspondent Chanabat reports from Kashmir.
Amid stringent security measures, counting of votes took place in Kashmir. The alliance of local parties emerged victorious by winning a maximum number of seats in the local administration. The elections in Kashmir come at a time when all the political processes in the region were halted after New Delhi stripped Kashmir's semi-autonomous status in August 2019. India's unilateral decision has not been accepted by the local pro-India political parties in Kashmir, and they aim to fight the decision. Victorious candidates and supporters perceive this win as a victory of people's verdict against what they call BJP's propagandist narrative on Kashmir. Political analyst Gohar Gilani says the results have clearly showed that the people of Kashmir stand by the People's Alliance. But at the same time, Gohar Gilani is critical of these local pro-India political parties considering their track records. After total 280 seats, the People's Alliance is leading, followed by BJP, Indian National Congress and others.
The local election results in Indian-administered Kashmir are seen by many as the new political chapter that would determine the future political discourse of this Muslim-majority region. Analysts say considering the political history of Kashmir, a deep-rooted mistrust in New Delhi and local pro-India political parties persists, and people here only seem to be choosing the lesser evil. Shahanabad, Indian-administered Kashmir.
The Ethiopian Human Rights Commission says armed men have killed more than 100 people in a village in the west of the country. The government-affiliated body said the pre-dawn attack took place in a village in the Metekel zone, home to multiple ethnic groups. The commission said at least 36 survivors were being treated for bullet and arrow wounds in a hospital. It added that crops were also set alight. A spokesperson for the government blamed anti-peace elements for the attack. On Tuesday, Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed traveled to the region to discuss the ethnic violence in recent months. In a tweet, he said, "The desire by enemies to divide Ethiopia along ethnic and religious lines still exists." And that brings us to an end here on this edition of the World News. Do stay tuned, though. Bye.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Assalamu alaykum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم.
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah. is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is a part of a speech delivered on October 12, 2020 by Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, via video conference with the participants at the joint graduation ceremony held at the Imam Ali Military Academy.
We speak about combating oppression on the basis of rationality. Therefore, our pursuit of justice and our social activities should be based on rationality and correct calculations as well. We should not busy ourselves with peripheral matters, and we should not confuse main and trivial matters. Of course, I mentioned that one element of our national power is our defensive power, but another element consists of economic matters and economic stability and strength. The last element is cultural matters. When the issue of cultural invasion arose, we found the enemy perplexed as he entered the arena with the idea of confronting the slogan of fighting against cultural invasion. This means that the enemy feared that you might awaken and might understand that there is a cultural invasion. The same is true of economic matters.
Your light and love, all I see, nothing more I'd ever want to need. My me from dishonor, grant me faith to be stronger.
Of course, economic problems result from pressure. In the present time, we have certain economic and livelihood problems, all of which are resolvable. I do not believe that officials in charge of economic matters are not working hard. This is not the case, as many efforts are being made, some of which are good. Of course, there are shortcomings in the area of management capability. We acknowledge that in certain economic areas, management efficiency is poor. We have passed good bills, but they should be pursued. I said this here so that as well as our defensive power, which is one of our most important issues, economic matters receive due attention, and so that we adopt a comprehensive outlook towards all these matters. Management in all areas should be strong, active, and untiring. Whenever we had managers with these qualities, tirelessness, activeness, and enthusiasm, we witness the progress of affairs, and whenever such active and constant presence is lacking, we certainly face problems.
Alhamdulillah, alhamdulillah, all praises to
The United States has spent the last two decades fighting an endless and unwinnable war in Afghanistan, with the conflict costing the US billions each year, as well as a loss of life on both sides, reminding us all of the embarrassing defeat suffered by the US in Vietnam. But with the US slowly outstaying its welcome in West and Central Asia, as demonstrated by the Iraqi parliament voting to oust them, it seems that Washington is intent on leaving a lasting legacy in the region, particularly in Afghanistan. A secret CIA-trained hit squad known as Zero One has been trained in Afghanistan, with evidence suggesting that the group, who operated under the cover of darkness, are responsible for a series of extrajudicial killings and executions across the country, and most worryingly of all, against civilians. Reports from numerous eyewitnesses and survivors suggest that as many as 51 innocent civilians have been killed, with the youngest amongst them being only 8 years old, as the terror group targets schools, medical centers, and other various institutions. With the raids apparently taking place across four districts in Afghanistan, and with most of the victims having no links to the Taliban, the question arises as to whether there's some kind of partnership between the CIA-trained operatives and the Taliban. According to multiple reports, the US has broken multiple rules of war, breached human rights, and has failed to deliver on any of the promises it made when it comes to building a secure Afghanistan. This raises the question as to just how the US can genuinely justify their presence in the country with so many operational failures in place.
The problem, we're talking about the U.S. presence in Afghanistan and what we call in this country collateral damage, is that there is no justification at this point after 18 years. We invaded Afghanistan allegedly to go after the Osama bin Laden, who it turns out was probably hiding in Pakistan. There was no way the Afghanistani government could accede to the demands that President Bush made when he made them in 2001. And, you know, so the justification is just not there. Now, after 18 years...
With attacks such as those completed by the Zero One unit, one official from the Afghan intelligence agency has stated that Americans have always been present during the Zero One raids. But the official failed to distinguish between the blurred lines as to whether the unit were special forces, task forces, or quite simply, CIA agents. What's clear is that the US has a very shadowy modus operandi, and this is something that seems to allow them to get away with the murder of civilians in the process. With pressure mounting on the US to leave Afghanistan and Iraq, could training such groups by the CIA and US forces guarantee a proxy unit for the US military in the area once they've left? We know from the past that the CIA has a long history of interfering in various sovereign states, and in particular, are keen to arm certain groups to the teeth in order to either justify their presence in an area, or quite simply allow splinter groups to carry out the dirty work on behalf of Washington and Langley. In fact, when one looks into the money involved in performing such tasks, the figures are quite boggling, with the CIA allocating some $2.5 billion of their budget to covert operations alone, a sum that equates to around 5% of the total intelligence purse. But when some of the groups backed by the CIA are actually fighting back against the US, including killing its military personnel in the area, does this not create a notion of double jeopardy for the US, showing just how desperate they are when it comes to maintaining a foothold in places such as Afghanistan?
It's a question of desperation. The Trump administration met with the Taliban about a year ago or 2 years ago, as far as we can tell, and basically said, if you stop killing Americans, then we can get out of here, basically. We don't care who else you're killing, but don't kill us. And we can work something out, but if you're killing us and killing our troops, then we're never going to be able to withdraw from here, because we're not going to withdraw under fire. That's basically the United States position.
There may be many similar cases around the world that have yet to come to light. This report, however, has finally exposed the CIA as the main funding party behind the execution of civilians. What remains to be seen is whether such groups will remain US proxies in the future and continue to allow the US to carry out a series of illegal operations, all whilst being able to deny being present at the time.
Mujahideen Khalq Organization, MKO, also known as the MEK, is a notorious anti-Iran terror group that embraces an ideology that mixes Marxism and terrorism. MKO's crimes against Iran run the gamut from collaborating with Iraq's former dictator Saddam Hussein during the 1980 to 1988 war on Iran to a violent campaign of bombings across the country. One of the group's highest profile acts of terror came on June 20, 1981, when a powerful bomb went off at the headquarters of an Iranian political party, the Islamic Republican Party, where the party's leaders were holding a meeting. The bombing killed scores of Iranian officials, including the then head of Supreme Judicial Council, Ayatollah Mohammad Beheshti. Iran's army chief, Major General Mousavi, said there were traces of MKO involvement in the assassination of Iran's top scientist Mohsen Fakhrizadeh last month. The anti-Iran organization has long been recognized as a terror group by much of the international community. However, in June 2008, the United Kingdom crossed the group off its terror list. The move was followed by the European Union in 2009 and the United States in 2012. Canada followed in the footsteps of the Western countries in delisting MKO as a terror group in December 2012 without offering any reason for the decision.
There's no coincidence because the conservative administration was in power at that time with the prime minister as Stephen Harper, and he was a pro-Zionist, pro-American type of politician. So whatever the Zionist lobbies wanted in Canada, he would work to implement that. Unfortunately, that the West has this double standard and hypocrisy that they use these groups to their benefit when they feel bankrupt.
Since removing its decade-long ban on the MKO, the Western nations, especially the United States, have used the group as a tool to pressure Iran. In September 2012, then U.S. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton said Washington was expunging the MKO from its list of designated terror organizations. The decision came after intense lobbying backed by prominent U.S. officials that included James Woolsey and Porter J. Goss, former CIA directors, Louis J. Free, the former FBI director, President George W. Bush's Homeland Security Secretary Tom Ridge, and Attorney General Michael Mukasey, and President Obama's first National Security Advisor, General James Jones. Many of the U.S. officials had been paid between $15,000 to $30,000 to deliver speeches to the group, as well as travel expenses to attend lavish rallies in Paris. Former Governor of Pennsylvania, Edward Rendell, said in 2012 that he had been paid a total of $150,000 to $160,000. In 2016 and 2017, Saudi Arabia's former spy chief, Prince Turki bin Faisal Al Saud, attended MKO meetings in Paris. Advanced with God's blessings, Ben Faisal said in a speech in the 2016 meeting, wishing the terrorists success in attempting, quote, regime change in Iran.
But this is hypocrisy because even the governments that come, I mean, the officials from different systems, such as the Saudi regime, you know, last year, a popular person from the Saudi regime came and said that he was in support of changing the system in Iran and bringing democracy, where we already know that Saudi Arabia is the furthest country from democracy. So how could somebody be supporting democracy when his own system itself is far away from democracy?
In 2018, another meeting in Paris attracted Rudy Giuliani, personal attorney to U.S. President Donald Trump, and Stephen Harper, a former prime minister of Canada. Pulitzer Prize winner Seymour Hersh reported in 2012 that a number of MKO members were secretly trained by the United States Joint Special Operations Command at the Department of Energy's Nevada National Security Site, a secretive training facility northwest of Las Vegas. The report was followed by another revelation in 2018 that the terrorists were receiving funds through Saudi smuggling networks and Saudi-linked black market sales to continue their subversive agenda. But what does this say about MKO supporters, except that they have become so desperate in their subversive attempts in Iran that they have turned to a cult group they once blacklisted as a terror organization?
The number of Americans seeking unemployment benefits continues to surge at unprecedented levels. Just last week, another 885,000 people filed for first-time unemployment, This is the highest level in the past 3 months. Since the start of the pandemic, more people have lost their jobs and incomes and have become dependent on assistance. Overall, about 20.65 million people are receiving unemployment benefits of some kind since the coronavirus pandemic started in the U.S. The loss of income made millions of American families food insecure. Throughout the pandemic, food banks and pantries have provided millions of Americans with much-needed food. Although hunger is not new in America, the pandemic has had a major impact. Food insecurity has become a widespread national issue, sparing not even some of the wealthier regions. A recent survey shows that 1 in 8 Americans reported that they sometimes, or often, did not have enough food. Overall, food insecurity has doubled since last year, reaching the highest level since 1998. Before the pandemic, the majority of the food bank's clients were the elderly and the underemployed. But there's been a recent influx of service workers who have been disproportionately hit by the COVID-19 crisis. Food insecurity rates spiked at the end of March when pandemic lockdowns made the U.S. economy stumble. People from Alaska to Georgia are turning to food distribution centers to pick up free groceries. Activists say that food banks are under extra pressure ahead of the upcoming holidays as requests have skyrocketed. They say that millions of Americans are barely making ends meet and need help to feed their families. Moreover, data by the U.S. Census Bureau indicate that more Americans are going hungry than at any point during the COVID-19 pandemic. The overall U.S. unemployment rate is currently 6.7%, which, while better than previous months, still means that 10 million pre-pandemic jobs have been lost. Economists have said that the jobs that have not returned by this point will be the hardest to claw back, because they're concentrated in the industries most affected by virus containment measures, like leisure, travel, and hospitality. This means that employment gains that people saw during Trump's presidency may not continue at the same pace under Biden. That is because prolonged unemployment, especially in a weak labor market, can be harder to fix. Analysts say that people who have been unemployed for 6 months or more are about twice as likely to drop out of the labor force as to find employment. Moreover, the longer a person is out of work, the less consumer purchasing they do, which further slows economic growth. Data shows that long-term unemployment as a share of unemployment is growing fast across America. In October, 3.6 million of the 11 million unemployed Americans had been out of work for 6 months or longer. That is a ratio not seen since mid-2014, when Biden was the country's vice president. The continuing unemployment crisis has led economists to become increasingly pessimistic about when the country might return to pre-pandemic levels. Business and academic economists surveyed by the Wall Street Journal in April predicted the labor market would recover by the year 2022. But when surveyed again in October, 55% had extended their recovery forecast to the year 2023 or later. In the meantime, there are those who believe the mass vaccination can make real change, but it could be months until the jabs are widely distributed.
Until a certain proportion within the population is not immunized, the impact of the vaccine cannot be visible. For instance, we have to vaccinate at least 70 out of 100 people to achieve the herd immunity. At that point, we will start seeing the benefit of the vaccine in breaking the transmission. Although the U.S. has urged to have 100 million doses in the first quarter of 2021, but even if that is started, what we're looking is that August, September would be the time when we will have the herd immunity in the United States. At that point, we will start seeing positive impact on. But before that, it is unfortunate, very grim situation.
As the world advances in its technological capabilities, so too then does the way in which various countries across the world need to protect its assets, particularly when it comes to data, information, and national security through the medium of computer-based hosts. The US has recently stated that it's become victim to yet another highly sophisticated cyber attack on its infrastructure, in particular with the attack aimed at multiple ministries across the US government. And more worryingly for the US, it seems that although discovered, the attack is still ongoing. Some of the departments have come out and announced that their systems have been breached at the Departments of Energy, the Treasury, and the Department of Commerce. At this stage, it's not clear which other departments have been hacked into, although there are reports that the National Nuclear Security Administration, which maintains the country's nuclear stockpile, has also been broken into. The US authorities have yet to admit that other more sensitive departments have also been targeted. The hacking appears to have started in March, targeting the Texas-based network security firm SolarWinds via their so-called Orion software, which was incidentally used by a host of US federal agencies and departments. It's unknown at this point as to just how serious the breaches have been, how much information has been obtained by the hackers, or what kind of information has been taken. But what is known is that some 18,000 people have uploaded the SolarWinds Orion update, loaded with the software, allowing the hackers in via the back door, a highly embarrassing situation for the US government. So does this incident suggest that the US is lagging behind in their capability when it comes to preventing such hacks? For a start, the US Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency, or CISA, has suffered a huge blow to their reputation, raising the speculation as to whether the US are becoming weaker or whether the hackers are simply getting smarter.
I think it's the latter. I think the hacking abilities have improved. And there's been a proliferation of a lot of private hacking entities, companies, corporations, et cetera, which have proved quite adept when it comes to penetrating the most tightly guarded software facilities.
The priority for the U.S. will now involve securing their cyberspace infrastructure and making sure that the damage done does not cost them too dearly. With more and more states becoming ever more aware and capable when it comes to cyber warfare, the US now have to contemplate who the authors of the cyber attack were and why they targeted the US in the way they did. After all, the US have a host of adversaries around the world. In typical fashion, the Americans have already pointed their fingers towards Moscow as the perpetrators of the attack, claiming that the technology can only have come from a sophisticated source backed by a state. However, the Russians have nonsensed the US claims, stating they do not participate in such acts. Kremlin spokesman Dmitry Peskov has been quoted as stating that the US should not put the blame of their own failures on Russia, claiming that Russia will not stand by and be blamed for anything and everything the US decides it needs a scapegoat for. With Russia being blamed, then, could the future of warfare between sovereign states turn to cyber-based attacks and hence see an elevation in frequency and sophistication in the near future?
Yeah, this is a big problem. I mean, attribution is very difficult. It's very difficult to figure out who was behind these attacks. And that's a big problem, because if there's a major disruption, a major attack in the U.S., and say, you know, power grids go out or emergency services are cut off or whatever, there'll be enormous pressure to retaliate. And therefore, the U.S. could respond in kind to Russia, only to discover months later that it really wasn't Russia at all.
With the White House and Donald Trump remaining eerily silent so far, the U.S. President-elect Joe Biden has come forward, stating that significant funds will be generated during his presidency to disrupt and deter adversaries in targeting the U.S. through cyber attacks. With cyber warfare fast becoming the new norm in global security issues, it seems that across the world, states need to both prepare themselves for cyber attacks and use the technique to secure an advantage over others as fifth-generation warfare fast becomes a new tool of the state. But more worryingly for all is the notion that individuals and lone actors are also capable and in fact more dangerous when it comes to security breaches in national security through the medium of cyber attacks. So next time you're on your computer, be careful. You have been warned.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
I'm a teacher.
I'm a researcher.
I'm a mother.
I'm a lawyer.
And I believe in acting kindly toward you, because you are
A Muslim lady.
You are very special. There's no one just like you.
From Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
You are very special, and I'm so glad you're mine.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah, brothers and sisters. Thank you so very much for joining us on today's episode of Muslim Lady. In the studio with me, I have my favorite guest, sister, and expert, Sister Razia Shamani. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah.
On our show, we've been discussing very interesting and eye-opening topic. We've been rediscussing it, actually, in a very interesting and eye-opening method. Mm-hmm. It's the topic of haya, modesty, which, fascinatingly enough, you have reintroduced to us all, putting it in a way that brought us to a new understanding in regard with this term, and that haya isn't necessarily something that is limited to women, and it does not mean shyness, it does not mean not being confident about who you are in your own skin. Rather, it means self-worth. It means dignity.
Uh-huh. In one beautiful hadith, Imam Musa ibn Ja'far, alayhi salam, he talks about the relationship between intellect or aql and haya.
Mm.
And if you compare haya to one of the body parts, and you compare aql to the whole human being, where would you see this haya? It's a really hard question.
So my brain is the body, and haya is one of the parts.
Yeah.
The eyes?
Exactly.
You won't get anywhere with your intellect unless, by intellect we mean ability to process the data that we receive from the world.
Mm-hmm.
And the number one tool that we use to receive data is our eyes.
Exactly. So your data collection would be canceled off without any haya, without any
eyes.
Exactly. Wow. So, and my understanding is certainly very, very, very low. You know, there's so much more depth to this beautiful hadith, but we're doing our best. There is another beautiful hadith. There's one from Imam Ali alayhi salam that talks about the reward of haya.
Wow. We get rewarded for this too? Exactly. Isn't the attribute itself so rewarding already?
You have it inbornly. I actually hadn't looked at it this way that you just mentioned. You're actually rewarded for possessing, to keep this virtue alive in your soul.
MashaAllah.
And you cannot imagine how much the reward is.
Really?
Like if I tell you, I want to give you the greatest reward, what comes to your mind?
Jannah. Heaven.
Uh-huh. Go a little bit lower. What would you do in this world? In what form will you have to be to get the highest reward?
I would have to be a martyr.
Exactly. It says, the reward of a struggler martyred in the way of God is not more than one who tries one's best to remain chaste.
MashaAllah.
So this wearing of the hijab,
right,
guarding your tongue, guarding the way you walk,
your
the way
temper,
you talk, your
the way
temper,
you treat other people.
This is like being a martyr.
SubhanAllah.
You know, a walking martyr. This is the beauty of the religion of Islam.
It really is.
It's shared by men and women, but I will tell you later on that women have a greater
Sharing.
They have been rewarded. They have been gifted more in this regard.
Yeah, they're the flag bearers.
Exactly.
How life changing.
Seriously, it changes your perspective towards life. If you truly understand the meaning of these concepts, then life maybe becomes more meaningful to
exactly.
you.
Exactly. Exactly. Life definitely does become more meaningful, and all the do's and don'ts of religion become more meaningful.
Exactly.
When Allah says, don't do certain things, don't go certain places, don't have certain relationships, it's because He does not want you to hinder your self-worth, you know, to bring down your own value. Mm-hmm. And that's on a whole other level than just heaven and hell.
Exactly.
Right?
Exactly.
It's so and now it brings me to this. It's like it's connecting all the dots. It brings me to that hadith from Amir al-Mu'minin Ali alayhi salam that says there are three types of servants, and then that the person who does good or refrains from bad just because of heaven and hell, he's just a merchant. And the person who does it for the sake of God, that's a real, like, abd. Because you feel like, dude, I'm worth so much more than this.
Exactly.
Never mind heaven, never mind hell, never mind the rewards. I'm human.
Exactly.
And God created me in his image, in all his glory.
The state of radiyat and mardiyat, to be satisfied with God and God is satisfied with you.
Beautiful.
This whole concept of love, you know? It boils down at the end to this relationship
always
between the creator and the creature.
Always.
My Lord, show me right from wrong. Give me light, make me strong. I know the road is long. Make me strong. Sometimes it just gets too much. I feel that I've lost touch. I know the road is long. Make me strong.
We're talking about the topic of haya, or modesty. We're redefining and reintroducing it. Not that because we came up with a new concept. It's the core meaning of it that people constantly misunderstand.
Mm-hmm.
And they think that haya is reserved for women. And the more you cover yourself with clothes, the more modest you are. I've seen a lot of women who cover themselves thoroughly, but they're like potty mouths.
Exactly.
They are so mean to their family, and they're inconsiderate toward their spouse, and they're not clean, and you know, they're not nice to their neighbors, they're not nice to nature. It doesn't matter. It's not defined by this covering, but this covering is one of its examples.
Exactly.
One of its manifestations.
Exactly. Mm. If you allow me, I would like to go to one of the terms that is closely related that we've already discussed,
mm-hmm.
we've already mentioned. Let's talk about ifaf.
Yes, let's.
Haya and ifaf are very, very closely
interwoven. Yeah.
Exactly. And you can, whenever you mention the word haya, then automatically the word ifaf comes with it.
Mm.
So let's talk about it. Let's first of all look at the meaning, the literal meaning of ifa, which means to abstain, you know, from something that might harm you. Okay?
Right. Then why is it always used in a sexual context?
I'm going to tell you. In other dictionaries, it could mean to be content with the little that you have.
So qana'a and ifa are kind of like,
yeah. They are also related. Another meaning of literal meaning of ifaf could be that not to beg people for something.
Wow.
Yeah.
Like that sense of pride.
Exactly.
Know? Yeah, okay.
Yeah, that sense of honor that you said here comes to play again.
Beautiful.
Right? In ethical terminology, the late Naraqi, he says that being afif, or having the character of chastity, it means that your intellect controls your carnal desires.
MashaAllah. In Arabic, we have haya, we have affa, we have taqwa, we have all these attributions, all these qualities.
They translate it as shyness, as modesty, as being ashamed, being, you know, it doesn't really get the word across.
It doesn't
across.
Do the word justice
exactly,
at all.
Exactly. So that's why we are re-paraphrasing it.
Yes.
We're reconstruing the topic. It's really helpful. It is specifically used in the realm of two inclinations, the stomach and the private parts. These two temptations or inclinations are
the strongest.
The strongest. And you see today, in today's world, everything is about food.
True.
Seriously, open the Instagram page. It goes somewhere, you know, into decorating the food, or the nutritious of the food,
or
the design.
Mukbangs, a camera in front of a person eating food.
Exactly.
Why?
Or it goes to sexual attractions. Like,
yes. Underclothes women and lustful men.
Exactly. They want to advertise a car. They have a lady. Seriously, when I was comparing car advertisements from 20 years ago until now, I remember when they wanted to advertise for Chevrolet, there was a handsome man coming and opening the door and, you know,
strong and butch and, yeah.
Now, they're all women, you know? And all these women are not, you know, they're very tall, look very firm and fierce. Yeah, exactly. So, or I've been watching, you know, on Instagram page, in the between the posts, there are advertisements of perfume.
And, oh my God.
Women. And lately, because of equality of rights of men and women, men.
Yeah, exactly.
So you see, it all boils down to food and private part. Yeah. I'm sorry to say that.
A few years back, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, he was talking about the media and that we are lacking and we are lagging and we're not doing enough to convey our concepts, these lofty, valuable concepts that we have through media, and that one of the reasons the Western media has an upper hand is because they kind of went like evil on it, because they used man's most carnal, not man by male, human beings' most carnal, most animalistic, and most pleasurable
desire.
Yeah, and interest, you know, to provoke the minds and to draw them into watching their movies. And this, and Hollywood is constantly promoting promiscuity. When haya come into the picture, however, I mean, this is
so not low, so
lowly,
cheap.
Exactly, so animalistic for me to spend my time, my eyesight, watching this.
Exactly. Okay, so in the next episode, inshallah, we'll be talking about the kinds of ifaf. Mm-hmm. As I'm going to mention verses in the Noble Quran that specifically talks about it. I'm just going to mention one of the verses. It's in chapter Baqarah, verse number 273, that it talks about two kinds of ifaf. Ifaf of the stomach and ifaf of the tongue.
Mm.
That ifaf of it's talking with actually a group of people that they are poor and that they don't have the means to go to other countries to migrate, to find other jobs, to study, whatever. And then other people think that these people are not poor.
Exactly.
Because of ta'affuf.
Mm.
Because they show themselves, they express themselves in a way that with the very, very little that they have, because of their sense of honor and dignity, they show themselves in such a high and respectable way that people, they say, oh, they're well off. They're fine.
They're comfortable. MashaAllah.
We're going to talk about this.
Inshallah ta'ala. Thank you so very much, Sister Razia. And thank you, brothers and sisters, for being with us on this journey. Inshallah, we'll meet up again on the next episode of Muslim Lady. Until then, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Who is the lover?
Allah.
Who is Ar-Rahman?
Allah.
Who is Al-Mannan?
La ilaha illa Allah. Muhammadur Rasulullah. Muhammad is the messenger. To Allah is our return.
The Quran, given by God to Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him and his family, more than 1400 years ago, as guidance for humanity.
La ilaha illa Allah.
Muhammadur Rasulullah.
Quran speaks about women.
The Quran teaches the equality of men and women in the eyes of Allah.
Chapter 33, verse 35.
All praise is due to the one and only. He is the master of all creation.
Modesty and chastity are encouraged by the Quran, both for women and for men.
Chapter 24, verses 30 and 31.
He's the sustainer and the maintainer of the whole universe.
God created us from one male and one female and made us into nations and tribes so that we make to know one another, not to despise each other.
chapter 49, verse 13.
The Quran has indicated